I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Friday's stock market sell-off continued this Monday when the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell almost 1,200 points. On Tuesday, the wild gyrations continued throughout the day, finally ending up 567 points. While those numbers are big, the percentages tell a different story. Nonetheless, we need to understand what this volatility is all about. And we asked Mark Zandi to join us. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Are we talking about a correction here?
Yeah, it's a correction. Definition of a correction is a 10% decline in stock prices from the peak. And before yesterday's rally, it was down about 10%. So this feels like, at least so far, a typical garden variety correction.
Correcting what?
Correcting froth in the market. I mean, even with this 10% decline, Mark, the stock prices are just back to where they were at the start of the year. So stock prices have been rocketing higher for quite some time, and this is just a bit of a pullback, something very typical, not uncommon, at least so far. You know, this is nothing to be too worried about.
When economists say froth, does that mean stock prices are or were inflated?
Yeah, of course. There's a lot of debate around that, right? I mean, like anything, you know, value is in the eye of the beholder. But I would say the market felt overvalued. It still does, even with this correction. And when I say that, generally, you think about the value of a stock in the context of the profits, earnings of companies, and interest rates. Those are the two key components of determining the value of a stock. And looking at those things, it did feel like stock prices, still does feel like stock prices are what you might call stretched, overvalued, a bit frothy.
I want to pick up on that. But let me ask you about something I was reading in preparation for our interview, that a lot of the trading had to do with machines or algorithms. Is that correct? And what does that tell us? What does that mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the good old days, you go back, a few decades ago, when trading was going on, it was between individuals, you know, buyer, seller, individual. You know, they're still buying and selling by individuals, but there's also buying and selling by a computer. The investors have programmed computers to trade based on algorithms, based on formulas, based on regularities that they've seen in stock price trading historically. So, yeah, a lot of the trading now is done by machines, by computers, and that does create the potential for much more volatility in stock prices, bigger ups, bigger downs in stock prices. And stock prices can move, you know, very quickly in a very short period of time. And, of course, we have seen that over the past few days.
And is that just because a computer can react so quickly, can sell and buy and sell and buy so quickly?
Instantaneously, right? I mean, immediately. So if, you know, something in the algorithm in the program says sell or buy, that's what happens quickly. And you got a lot of machines doing this all over the planet. So, and by the way, this does mean that markets move all over the world closely together. So if the U.S. stock market heads south, then it takes everyone with it. So, you know, this computer trading, you know, there's benefits to it, but one of the potential costs, at least intuitively, is it creates this potential for big swings in stock prices in very short periods of time.
So robots are controlling our economy, our financial system?
They're controlling much of everything, right? So
yeah,
no reason to suspect it would be any different in the stock market or the rest of the financial system.
Mark, let me ask you, broadly speaking, what you made of the coverage. There was a kind of the sky is falling coverage from some corners on what the stock market was doing in the last couple of days. People that had stocks were, frankly, scared.
Yeah, I mean, it's not atypical, right? That always happens. But I do think, if you're in the stock market, if you're invested in stocks, you have to have a longer-term horizon. That means you can't be invested for tomorrow or right. Next week or next month or even next year. You have to be in this for the long haul, because stocks go up and down and all around, and you just have to look through it. In fact, probably, for most of us, unless you're actually in the business of, trading stocks, probably even shouldn't be looking. You know, certainly not getting worried about, you know, up or down. And again, you got to put this into context, right? I mean, stock prices are down for sure from where they were, you know, 10 days ago, but they're about where they were at the start of the year, and they're still up 20% or so from where they were a year ago. And just think about it, over the last 8-9 years, stock prices have been basically been heading straight north since the financial crisis back almost 9 years ago.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. We asked him to join us in this first segment of Radio Times today to talk about what the stock market has been doing and what it all means. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This did, Mark, coincide with the new Fed chair taking over, Jerome Powell. Do you think there was some coincidence there, or was the stock market, in a sense, worried about what Powell might do compared to Janet Yellen?
Yeah, how would you like that for your first day on the job?
Exactly. Ouch.
Bummer, you know? Wow, really? Can I have a, you know, a little bit of a honeymoon here? No relationship. I mean, the relationship here between what the Fed and the market, though, is that this economy is getting very hot. I mean, unemployment is low, which is a great thing. But, you know, if it gets too low, the problem is that you start to get inflationary pressures, fears of inflation, and that means higher interest rates. And higher interest rates, we can talk about this if you want, but higher interest rates are not good for stocks. Also, interest rates are headed higher because of those deficit finance tax cuts, right? I mean, the government is going to go out and borrow a lot of money, issue a lot of bonds to pay for the tax cuts for businesses and individuals. It's a lot of money, and so all that increased borrowing is driving up interest rates, and that's not good for stocks. So there is a link between the Fed and the markets, and, you know, most fundamentally, but it's not because Jerome Powell became chair of the Fed. You know, he'll do just fine. He'll be a great Fed chair.
But do you think people just got used to having a essentially free money for the last almost decade?
Yeah, certainly they've gotten investors have really enjoyed the low interest rates, and, you know, the Fed has been very aggressive in trying to help the economy out, stimulate the economy. I mean, it's hard to remember, but, you know, 9 years ago we went through a pretty debilitating downturn. It was scary, actually.
It was,
you know,
scary.
Yeah, it was scary. You know, people are forgetting that, but that was pretty scary. So the Fed had to respond to that, and it kept interest rates very low for a long period of time. And that, again, that low interest rates are good for stocks. But now that the economy is strong, and it has been strong for quite some time, unemployment's been declining steadily for quite some time. And now we're at a point where the Federal Reserve has to take away, you know, those very low interest rates, and to a significant degree, the stock market is just adjusting to that reality.
But it does raise questions about whether the stock market is a reflection of our overall economy. If more people are employed and if wages are going up, broadly speaking, that's good for people. But the stock market doesn't seem to like that.
Yeah, well, you know, the stock market has its own dynamics. You know, what's that old quip? I think it was Paul Samuelson, a well-known economist, said something like the stock market has predicted, you know, 10 of the last 5 recessions, you know. So there is information in the stock market, particularly if it's declining. I mean, it always declines before recessions when we're going into the soup, but it also declines for reasons that are completely independent of the economy, or at least how the economy is doing at that point in time. And this recent correction is, you know, an example of that. But it is important to recognize that, you know, investors in stocks are looking into the future. So, you know, the economy today might be great, but if they're thinking, 6, 12, 18, 24 months from now, it's not going to be so great because of what's going on, then they could sell stocks. So, you know, you could look at the unemployment rate, great today, but the stock investors are saying, well, it's not going to be so great a year from now.
But interestingly, the tax bill in many ways rewarded Wall Street. There have been some pretty serious cuts in regulations since President Trump has been president. I'm assuming that people with stocks and people that work on Wall Street are crowing because of all these good things that have happened.
Yeah, and they benefited, right? I mean, one of the reasons why stock prices are up 20% from a year ago, a big reason why is those tax cuts. I mean, you just do a little bit of arithmetic, the tax cuts, probably half that 20% increase is due to to the lower tax rates on corporations just by themselves. It's just that the stock market took that and ran with it, and you know, it is, you know, affected by sentiment, and 10 days ago the euphoria was running pretty thick. So I think investors just got ahead of themselves and loved the lower tax rates, but took it even beyond that. And that this correction is taking that away, taking that, as I said, froth away.
Is there any connection between the volatility on the stock market and the partisan fighting in Congress, or even the president yesterday essentially threatening a government shutdown? Does that resonate or penetrate Wall Street at all?
Well, that's a tougher set of dots to connect. You know, the president's been doing this stuff for over a year, and, you know, why now would the stock market react? It could be, you know, here's the metaphor. Take a grain of pile of sand, and, you know, every time the president tweets, it's another grain of sand on the pile, right. And nothing happens. You don't know, but, you know, one more tweet, one more threat of a government shutdown, that's another grain of sand on the pile in the pile cave. So that could be what's going on here. But, you know, my sense is the market is just, pulling back from a very strong run up, and also just getting used to the idea that, you know, look, the interest rates are going to be higher here, and the long period of very low interest rates, easy money, is over.
How about debt? Is that a worry?
Yeah, I think so. That's added to the interest rates, as I pointed out. I mean, these tax cuts they're deficit finance, meaning they're not paid for, meaning we're borrowing money as a nation to pay for them. We're going out, the Treasury, U.S. Treasury is issuing bonds to global investors and using that money to cut a check to businesses and individuals. And that just adds to the nation's, of course, deficits and debt. And just to give you a sense of the numbers, last year, the U.S. Treasury issued roughly $500 billion worth of bonds. This year, they're going to issue over $1 trillion worth of bonds. That's a big increase.
Awesome.
That means you got to go find buyers for those bonds, and to get them to buy, you got to give them a higher interest rate, right? And so that's part of what's going on here, too.
Mark, we're almost out of time. We got an email from Donald. Could you ask if the market is reacting to Ms. Yellen's comment on the NewsHour last Friday that the market is overvalued?
Maybe. There's been a lot of people worried about the market, including me, Marty. You might have picked up the piece I wrote in the Sunday Inquirer,
yep.
A couple Sundays ago, saying roughly the same thing. So there's been a bunch of voices out there saying, you know, things are getting a little ahead of themselves. And when you have a voice, a strong voice like Chair Yellen, that carries some weight. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are thinking this market has gotten ahead of itself, and they'll take advantage of it until they see the market starting to crack a little bit, and then they bail. And then that's when you get a day like the one we got where prices were down 1,200 points.
Mark Zandi, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's chief economist at Moody's Analytics. We're taking a very short break, and then we'll be talking about the Korean Peninsula. We have a guest waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Athletes from North and South Korea are marching together under one flag at the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics taking place in Pyeongchang, South Korea, later this week. This act of unity is a far cry from the typically tense relationship between the two countries, who fought a bloody war more than 60 years ago called the First War of the Cold War, with the U.S. supporting the South and the Soviet Union and China supporting the North. The Americans reportedly dropped more than 500,000 tons of bombs and more than 30,000 tons of napalm on the North, destroying much of the country. An armistice was signed in 1953, but that is not the same thing as a peace treaty. Today, how the past explains the present on the Korean Peninsula. This news, Kim Jong-un's sister will attend the Olympics opening ceremony, as will Vice President Mike Pence, who said he didn't want North Korea to hijack the Winter Games. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Frank Planton. He is co-director of the International Relations Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Frank, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, any questions or comments, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Korea is often called the forgotten war in this country. I mean, clearly the men who fought in that war have not forgotten it. For a lot of the rest of the country, I think we largely have. Is that true on the Korean Peninsula?
Oh, in Korea itself? Surveys every year around June 25th, on the anniversary of the outbreak of the Korean War, one of the big newspapers does a survey. And you would be stunned at the data. I mean, it's surprising. Things on 60-70% of young people have almost no knowledge of the outbreak of the war or who started it. There's a lot of misinformation among people in Korea about it. This is part of legacy as a reaction to the period of the dictatorship under Park Chung-hee and Chun Doo-hwan and others.
In South Korea, yep.
Yeah, because they were force-fed anti-communist propaganda in schools for many years. And so when, you know, democratization came in 87, 88, the big movement and free elections occurred, one of the very first things people did is they stopped teaching it. Like, I've complained for years that they don't teach the Korean War in Korean universities. And so there is a lack of knowledge, really, about the outset of the war. Now, not among the older generation, people who suffered, right. And you know, young people that do the kind of thing like, "Oh, there goes Grandpa talking about the war again."
But with the eye roll that goes along with that,
there is a lot of misunderstanding, even in modern Korea today, about the origins of the war.
How about the North? I mean, in many ways, the North has kept this war alive, has it not?
Well, anyone commenting about the popular opinion of people in the North is speculating. it is really the nickname of Korea being the Hermit Kingdom definitely applies to North Korea. They have managed to control and keep information out very successfully for 60 years. It may be the closest thing to a purely totalitarian state on the planet.
Yeah.
But in the socialization of the population, the indoctrination to Juche philosophy there of Kim Il-sung, the founder of modern North Korea, has all led to a belief, and it's daily. It's in the news. It's on billboards. It's on posters. It's in textbooks. It's in schools. Is that the American imperialists, you know, have kept the country separated, and that we're responsible, and we started the war, basically, is the propaganda in North Korea.
Well, let's talk about the war. And even before the war, in the Korean Peninsula, was actually occupied by Japan before the end. I guess the World War II, things changed after that. But nonetheless, it was a Japanese, colony?
Yes. It actually had been annexed. After Japan's rise, became a modern country, joining, trying to compete with the West, they fought two big wars, 1895 with the Chinese, and then the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905. The negotiation of the Taft-Katsura Treaty between Japan and the United States is where the original kind of division of the country can almost trace back to that at one point or another. But the problem in Korea, I just have to back up for a second, is they've been overrun by great powers and neighbors for years. There have been, some people have counted as many as 900 invasions in 2,000 years.
Wow.
So it's a small country surrounded by great powers who has, you know, been the victim of great power rivalry in the past. So Japan gets claim after the Russo-Japanese War to Korea. And so they occupy the country in 1905. In 1910, they annex it. So it becomes a province, officially a province of Japan. And so it's a Japanese territory colony for until the war ends in World War II. So the Korean language is banned, Japanese is official language, lots of atrocities occurred, hundreds of thousands of Japanese got moved to Japan. I mean, it's a legacy that leaves a lot of bitterness in contemporary Korea.
Dean Rusk drew the boundary along the 38th parallel. And what did he get right? What did he get wrong by doing that?
You know, the run-up to this goes back to the Potsdam-Yalta conferences in World War II, and Stalin and FDR and Churchill are trying to carve out the post-war world. And there was the Cairo conference, a promise that Korea would be independent eventually. But they didn't know the legacy of this country being a free and independent state for 2,000 years, and there were attitude sentiments, particularly in America, that they weren't ready to be totally free and that they would go through the UN trusteeship system.
Because they were Korean or Asian?
And this gets tied up with the fact that the whole idea that we were going to lose a million people if we invaded Japan. This is they were trying to get the Soviets to enter the war. They were very cagey about when and not wanting to open another front in World War II. But they agreed that they would join the war at a certain point in time. Well, after the atomic bomb gets dropped, the Soviets declare war on Japan. they come in and occupy the war comes to an end on August 15th of 44. And immediately the Soviets move in and occupy much of northern what is now North Korea. The U.S. didn't have troops there. We didn't. The worry was that the Soviets taking the whole peninsula. And so there was a rush literally overnight to figure out where we're going to draw the boundaries based on the previous agreement. So Dean Rusk and a guy named Bonesteel are sitting in Washington, and they're literally looking at the only map they have is some National Geographic map.
They're not even on the peninsula. They're in Washington.
Yeah, and they're looking at a bad map. Old National Geographic map out of a magazine, and they drew the line there at the 38th parallel. And so that's where the division starts, and why Koreans feel the great powers, U.S. and Soviet Union, divided the country. And there's real bitterness about that, even today.
Well, I do want to play President Truman. This is a televised address to the American people. This was July 19th, 1950, shortly after North Korea essentially invaded the South. And let's hear what President Eisenhower had to say.
Korea is a small country, thousands of miles away. But what is happening there is important to every American. On Sunday, June 25th, communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea. Free nations must be on their guard more than ever before against this kind of sneak attack. We are united in detesting communist slavery. We know that the cost of freedom is high, but we are determined to preserve our freedom no matter what the cost.
And, of course, that was President Harry Truman, not Eisenhower, my mistake. Mm. But nonetheless, why did the United States want to get into this war?
Well, the larger, bigger geopolitical picture is that at the end of World War II, the Soviets, took over most of Eastern Europe. There was the famous Churchill speech in Kansas about the Iron Curtain has fallen, and it became very evident that also with the defeat of the Chinese nationalists in China, the People's Republic of China, the Chinese communists taking over China, the threat of global communism and the expansionist, frankly imperialist policies of Stalin at the time, got confronted with things that we felt betrayed from previous by an ally from World War II. Right at about the same time, Truman has a National Security Council Memorandum 68, which is what defines the containment policy and sets the tone for the Cold War for the next 60 years. And Korea is the front line. This is the test case for it. And
kind of a proxy war between these competing powers?
We might say that. And much more complicated than that. I think I mentioned to you once before that, it started off really as kind of a civil war.
Yeah.
People don't realize that at the end of World War II, there were literally more registered communists in South Korea than in North Korea. And when martial law gets imposed in South Korea, there's something called the Daegu Uprising. There's fighting between communists and non-communists up and down the peninsula, both in North and Southern Korea. So the geopolitical context, it's imposed on already, who's going to lead the country after the war. And there emerges, in North Korea, Kim Il-sung, and in the South, Syngman Rhee. Both with the same goals. They wanted to reunify the country
under
by force.
Yeah,
Syngman Rhee,
control.
Too, wanted to invade North Korea and was restrained by Americans many different times.
I said in my introduction, but I just want to have your response. So the Korean War essentially lasts about 3 years. The bombing campaign, U.S.-led bombing campaign on the North, 635,000 tons of bombs.
Yeah.
And I saw a quote from Dean Russ. Basically, the U.S. bombed everything that moved,
everything.
Or at least that was the goal.
It's hard to imagine the legacy of this. I always said I was fortunate to see Korea. I went there first in 1975, so I saw it from when it was dirt poor to the modern high-tech country we see, large industrialized democracy we see today. And I can remember in Southern Korea, hillsides denuded of trees, and you could see the potholes and the shell holes and the bunkers and things everywhere. And North Korea was worse, much far, far, far worse. A lot of the flooding and the contributed to the famine later in the 90s even goes back to the fact that the mountainsides were denuded, and they didn't do what the South Koreans did, which was they had a National Arbor Day every year. I mean, the government in South Korea, everyone had to take off work and go plant trees for decades, and part of the reason South Korea is green has to do with this legacy of trying to turn the country green again. North Korea literally moonscaped from the bombing during the war.
Even to today, largely.
Today, lots of it you'll see. It's not quite the same. It's had 60 years, but you can still see evidence of the bombing.
Well, we are talking about the Korean War, helping us understand the conflict on the peninsula, and of course, the Winter Olympics taking place in just a couple of days in South Korea. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're sort of going quickly through the war here, but I do want to get up to the present day. The war ended in 1953 in an armistice. Mm-hmm. That is not the same thing as a peace treaty.
No.
What? So technically, the North and South are still at war.
And with the United Nations countries, all 15 countries have participated in the conflict. Actually, South Korea didn't sign the armistice. Syngman Rhee refused to at the time.
Wanting to fight on?
Yes, and reunify the country. He felt a little betrayed by the U.S. He kept saying, we got to keep fighting. Most of the fighting occurred in the very first year of the war. I mean, then the stalemate set in. It was 2 years of stalemate and fighting over little, like Pork Chop Hill, which is famous, right. But you get hundreds of American soldiers dying for no reason other than a negotiating position in Panmunjom, right? So the stalemate was on by July of 1951, and so it's 2 years of fighting over hills and hilltops, showing resolve that we were going to fight until we could get a settlement. So armistice comes along, and that imposes the DMZ, which is a line drawn at that 38th parallel where, soldiers on both sides had to be 2,000 meters back. So it's a 4,000-meter-wide demilitarized zone that runs for 151 miles across the peninsula.
How many Americans died? American soldiers, how many died?
Died in the war?
Yep.
If you count those who later died from industry and disease, about over 54,000.
Wow.
There were about 110,000 casualties, U.S. casualties in the war. Estimates vary. No one really knows how many people were killed. The safe number is 3 million. And of that, you know, probably 2 million are civilians on both
largely
sides.
Largely in the north?
And south.
And south as well.
Yeah. The Chinese lost estimates. We don't know a firm number. They've never announced it, but estimates are as many as 900,000 Chinese were killed. Mm-hmm. I'm always reminding people that we forget that we were fighting China at one time in recent history, and we killed 900,000 Chinese in Korea. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of forgotten as well, I think.
Well, it is often, as I said, probably more in this country than on the peninsula, but the forgotten war. I also was reading that there was a fair amount of censorship of the American press of that war. Is that true? So that there wasn't, perhaps like Vietnam later, you know, there were everyday reports. True, not true?
I've never looked at that, so you've stumped me a bit. I mean, if the reporting of the time is this, again, the larger geopolitical and containment policy, but, you know, I've never made a study of, you know, how was the war reported on back home, you know.
Well, there was this armistice. So did both sides think they had won, or did they?
Well, yeah, North Korea still claims they won.
Right.
I mean, that's part of the government's propaganda campaign is that they won the war. I don't know that anyone claimed we won. It's a stalemate. You know, we felt Americans have tried actually many times to leave the peninsula. The most notorious example was under Jimmy Carter. He was going to withdraw all troops against the advice of his advisors, the State Department, the U.S. military. I mean, it's one of the, I think, big and he admitted later that he could never explain why he wanted it done. He owned up to that. But he was determined to remove troops. He didn't like Park Chung-hee or the dictatorship, the violation of human rights that was going on during the dictatorship. And part of his human rights policy was driving that.
We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about North Korea, South Korea, the Korean War, the peninsula, what the past has to do with the present. Frank Plantin is our guest, and we're going to take that short break. We'll get right back. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Just a recap here with the Winter Olympics set to begin this week in Pyeongchang, South Korea. We're getting a history lesson on how the Korean War helps explain current tensions on the Korean Peninsula, also how it helps to explain U.S.-North Korea relations. And again, our guest is Frank Plantin, and he's co-director of the University of Pennsylvania's International Relations Program. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me get Robert in on the conversation. He's calling us from Philadelphia. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm not really sure, but as I understand history, and I'd like your answer on this, in a sense, all this is Douglas MacArthur's fault, the great general, apparently. But when he was in Japan and he was, like, basically the emperor of Asia at that point, he put out a map of zones of American concern, and he left Korea off that map. And when the North Koreans saw that, they said, well, America doesn't care about Korea, we'll attack. And then after they attacked and the American forces started driving the Koreans up the peninsula, that the Chinese said, we don't care about Korea, but just don't come within 50 miles of the Yalu River. And MacArthur was like, nope, we're going all the way to the Yalu. And when he crossed within 50 miles of the Yalu River, in came a million Chinese and pushed the Americans back, you know, all the way to the tip till he was gotten rid of. And another general came in, I forget his name, and regrouped the American forces and got him back to the 38th parallel.
Well, you know, Robert, let me take your essential question. I appreciate that history lesson and the call as well. Is this all Douglas MacArthur's fault?
Well, it depends how you want to parse it out. I will correct one thing the caller said. It was Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of the State, and in a speech at the Washington Press Club, notorious speech where they defined the area where the United States considered its defense interests, where they would lie. And in drawing that, they left off Taiwan and Korea.
Ah.
And it was that speech that people argued sent the signal to Kim Il-sung in North Korea that the Americans are not going to defend the South Korea. It is true, MacArthur pressed the war. He wanted, in fact, there was a big battle actually over the use of nuclear weapons. He wanted to use nuclear weapons on the Chinese side of the border to stop the supply of their troops later. It eventually led to Truman dismissing him.
Mm.
So there's whether the Chinese would have entered the war or not, depend whether if, you know, where was the line drawn, 50 miles from Yalu? It's possible we could have negotiated something at that point. But, you know, I think it remains, we'll never know totally what would have brought the Chinese in. But coming close to Yalu, that was a trigger, definitely.
Let me jump ahead a little bit. Mm-hmm. And just to summarize, North Korea, I mean, clearly is anti-American, as mm-hmm. we are anti-North Korea.
Right.
Is that based on literally what the United States did to North Korea during the Korean War?
No, well, I mean, they're not victims. They started the war. Kim Il-sung, you know, was in the process of consolidating power himself, you know. He had competition before kind of the Soviets deigned him as going to be the leader to support.
And he's the grandfather of the current.
He's the grandfather of the current Kim Jong-un. And so, I mean, part of this is the necessity to maintain unity, to maintain the military spirit in Korea, to maintain the readiness. I mean, they're on like perpetual war footing in North Korea. And one way to do that is you have to have, you know,
an enemy.
An enemy, the U.S. imperialists who they continue to claim are trying to destroy North Korea. I blame the North Koreans as much as, I mean, war is war. It's an unfortunate thing. It was a horrible, horrible conflict. But it's not like we went in there to kill all the North Koreans on the planet.
Well, let me play something that President George W. Bush said. This was January 29th, 2002, at his State of the Union address. And here he is referring to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction. These regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
Well, of course, we went to war in Iraq. I mean, it seems that was sending a very power. We weren't in Iraq at that moment, but nonetheless, that was sending a message to North Korea.
Well, yeah, and I mean, there's a decade run up to this. We had the first nuclear crisis was in 1994 when Kim Il-sung was still alive. We negotiated an agreement where they would give up the pursuit of nuclear weapons in exchange for us building a couple light water nuclear reactors in North Korea. Parties on all sides violated that agreement, but in the West it was perceived that the North Koreans were not abiding by the agreement. And there was domestic pressure, you know, to be critical of the Clinton administration by the Republicans at the time as well. So I think by the time 2002 rolls around, North Korea is already well on the way to developing its nuclear program. It's been developing ballistic missiles through that whole entire period. They're dealing with people, not friendly countries. They're sending technology, missile technology to Iran. They're, you know, sending, we know, missiles to Yemen later. They get caught. They are exporting, supporting bad groups that were contrary to U.S. policy at the time. You know, the bigger consequence of this is the invasion. What the invasion of Iraq did is, you know, I believe, and this is arguable, I think the North Koreans felt they were their next in line.
Sure.
And had the war not been bogged down as we got bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a likelihood that, they certainly believe that they were next. And then when they looked at failures of what happened to Gaddafi when he gave up his nuclear weapons, and then he gets ousted, and they just look around and say, we can't believe the Americans, we're not going to negotiate, they're out to extinguish us. So, you know, the politics of this, we can look at them and say they're crazy, that they're the people causing the problem by developing missiles. But, you know, they've been a very tough group to negotiate with. We've made our own mistakes and our own postures over the time that can exacerbate problems there.
Let me read a tweet from Jamie. My grandfather fought in the Korean War, was a Purple Heart recipient. I'm often bothered by the lack of information and attention paid to this particular war. Yeah. I often wish he was still alive and often wonder what he'd think about current affairs. And I think Jamie's not alone. This was, you know, as you said, 50,000, who knows the correct number, people that died, Americans that died in that war.
I'm working right now on a Korean War memorial in Montgomery Township with a large group of those political backing by both parties in the state and U.S. congressmen and others and the Korean government. And what we've learned is that, you know, once you get beyond the Korean War in the 60-something years since, over 3 million Americans have served to preserve the peace on the peninsula. A lot of American servicemen are Korean vets or Korean War vets, not just those who fought in the war.
Right. We have, what, 20,000 troops there or something?
No, it's about 26,000 to 27,000 right now. And I'm always encouraging Korean War veterans when I meet them to go back. The Korean government, South Korean government, treats them like royalty. They ought to see the country that they saved today, this modern, hyper-modern industrial democracy, vibrant, beautiful country. And most Korean War veterans, they have the worst memories. They think all they know is hell on earth.
Which it was.
And which it was for many of them.
Yeah.
Real heroes in the Korean War, many, many, many stories. And I honor her father for serving there and being Purple Heart. You know, he needs to be remembered properly.
Indeed. Let me get Brad from, looks like Pottstown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Brad. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to make an observation and reinforce what you were saying about Korea being in a permanent state of war. I went there in 1982 with the Foreign Service and did construction at the American Embassy. And once a month, Seoul would go into an air raid, and everybody had to evacuate and be off the streets. And you'd see, we'd go under the roof of the American Embassy and watch buses and taxis and the cars just pull right over and everybody scamper into the buildings. And jets would fly over the city and tanks would race up and down the street. Yeah. And they would do this every month.
Yeah, right.
It was, you know, to reinforce with the population that they're still at war and an attack could come at any time.
Brad,
and
the
guy I went with had been there in 1975, and he said the same thing you did. The country had changed dramatically when we were there in, you know, the mid-'80s.
Well, Brad, I appreciate it. That's one heck of a story there.
Yeah.
Does that still
I have similar – no, not at all. In fact, last year when they were trying to do some air raid drills at the height of the missile launches, I mean, it was not taken seriously. I mean, you saw people in the Seoul subway system laughing and taking pictures of the soldiers running through the subway system. And my feeling on this is actually if they wanted to send a real message to North Korea – they should get serious about civil defense. I mean, there is enough underground bunkers and between the subway system and the high rise, to put the entire population of Seoul underground. Literally, they have the capability of doing that, and they don't.
How many millions of people?
Well, 12 million in Seoul proper, and then Gyeonggi province is 26 million people. But they can if they were serious about it. I think that would send a real message to North Korea, but it could also be seen as preparing for war. So it's a tough call what to do there. I don't miss the air raid drills. I remember that there was curfew, and if you go around the street after curfew, you'd get arrested, you know. Those days are gone.
Brad, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me play one more clip. This is President Donald Trump speaking to the press about Kim Jong-un, and this is August 8th, 2017.
He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
I mean, that's beyond access of evil.
Yeah.
That's a direct threat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's not diplomatic. It's his advisors, his own military brass, from McMaster to Mattis to others, have wished he had not said it. It takes negotiations off the table in many regards. And, you know, if you're dealing with someone whose psychology isn't given to, in the North, to talking as well,
it can only
exacerbate the problems that are there right now. And if you're a South Korean, you're really worried. What is the nature of U.S. Security guarantee? In the past, they've always felt we're not going to go to war. North Korea knows it would lose. And so they felt that the deterrent effect of U.S. forces being present there and the fact that the South Koreans are much more superior technologically could probably defend themselves even. But this has a message, you know, it wasn't just the Fire and Fury speech. It was Trump saying that he expected America first, other countries to defend themselves. That's what causes worry in South Korea, is the American defense security commitment, you know, ironclad.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, that gets us to present day. Yeah. Interestingly, Kim Jong-un's sister is going to be at the opening ceremony. Vice President Mike Pence is going to be there as well. There was some vague hint that maybe there would be some conversation between leaders of both countries. Who knows whether that's going to happen or not. What do you make of the fact that North and South Korea are coming in under one flag at the games, the opening ceremony?
I mean, Koreans uniformly, I think, think that's an important symbolic act. There is a concept called, you know, Hanara, one country. Mm-hmm. And Koreans North and South, they talk about we Koreans. I mean, culturally, historically, they feel these are their kin, right? And so symbolically, it's important that they do this. There are a lot of conservatives in South Korea are a little angry with President Moon right now for some of the accommodations he's made to them, like putting North Korean ice hockey players on the women's hockey team actually incensed people in South Korea. I don't know that they should be competing as one team, but marching under one flag is important symbolically for and gives some hope that someday the Korea might be unified again.
I mean, is that we're almost out of time here, but that hope still exists, even though these countries are so different.
I think if you surveyed people, particularly in the South, that yeah, they believe in it, but they don't see it as a reality. It's something an ideal future that doesn't exist. I mean, if you look at treatment of North Korean defectors, there are about 20,000 in South Korea now. They're not well treated in South Korea. They're linguistically different. They're culturally different. They have a hard time getting jobs. They form their own NGOs to lobby for their political and civil rights in South Korea. It's not been a paradise for North Korean defectors in South Korea. And if you think back when the Germans reunified, you know, the East Germans weren't well treated by the West Germans either. You know, they were a little low class and rough around the edges. And I think the idea of reunification is an ideal. I think South Koreans would prefer that we maintain the status quo. Let's live in harmony, coexist to the extent possible over time, develop trade and exchanges and family connections. But I don't think there's any hope that this is going to lead to something more. In fact, I think it's a pause. I think after the Olympics, we may see another missile test or nuclear test shortly after the Olympics.
Well, time will tell. Frank Plantin, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Yeah. Co-director of the International Relations Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.